Welcome to My Pocket Psych. Each episode, we'll focus on aspects of work that can sometimes cause us problems. We'll explain why that's the case, and we'll offer some advice on what you can do about it. We'll highlight the areas of working life where you can make a positive change. We want to help you move from surviving work to thriving at work. And we'll avoid fads and nonsense that are spread on the internet, and we all know there's a lot of both of them out there. We'll minimize the psychobabble, we'll involve the experts, and we'll share it all with you in a sensible and accessible way. I'm Dr. Richard McKinnon, Managing Director of WorkLife Psych, and here's my co-host, Pilar Ortiz. Hi, Pilar.
Hi, Richard. Hi, listeners. What have you got for us today, Richard?
What have I got for you? Okay, well, no pressure. So we're going to talk about two big things today. We're going to talk about the world of coaching. Coaching is something I do a lot of. We're going to try and clarify what coaching is, what it's not, how coaching is different from other kinds of relationships that might be in the workplace, and maybe talk about some of the things that coaching can be helpful for, because it's not right for everything. And then we're going to look at the second of our three conversations on the theme of psychological flexibility. So you may remember last time we looked at how to show up and be mindful and be present. This time we're going to look at how to let go of worrying thoughts and emotions.
Wow. Well, I'm really looking forward to that because I find it quite difficult to let go of some stuff sometimes.
Oh, me too. Me too. It's not a panacea. But before we get into that, a couple of thoughts from our previous episodes I thought I'd bring us back to before we move on, and a bit of news.
Yes, go for it. So, yeah.
Well, the last time we talked about adopting a more mindful approach to work, and I was thinking, is there anyone out there who's tried that? Because we had some ideas, some suggestions and simple things that you could do, maybe decreasing the amount of multitasking you do. So do get in touch with us if you're trying this out. We'd love to hear how it's working for you. Now, this week, I had an experience of a more mindful approach to work, though not by choice. I had some problems with my desktop computer here in my office, and whatever went wrong with it, it would only let me open one browser tab at a time, and only the browser. Other apps weren't working. And after getting slightly frustrated, I realized this is unitasking. This is literally doing one thing at a time. And so it forced me to be really careful about what I was going to do next, because I couldn't have two things open at the same time. And I suppose it was, enforced mindful attention. But it really helped me get some writing done. So maybe that's a setting we could introduce into our computers. Only let me do one thing at a time.
That, now that you're mentioning it, so I usually work from my laptop, which is really good, great operating system. And recently, my husband got me a very incredibly affordable computer for the co-working space. It's very affordable, but of course, I don't think the processor is as great. And also, I think there was something going on with the internet. And you're right, that really forced me not to be able to do show notes, image, plus this, plus this, plus this at the same time, and one thing at a time. So maybe there's... Maybe there's something there. And sometimes if we're finding ourselves like we're just breaking down everything and trying to do lots of stuff at once, think back to when it was, what it was like when tech was a bit slower and our computers couldn't take us much. And that can slow us down, because I think technology is great. It's allowing us to do all this stuff. But because of that, we're getting used to doing a lot of stuff at a time.
Yeah. And it meant for me no notifications. And yes, I have minimal notifications set up on all my devices because I hate being interrupted. Yeah. But there are a couple of things, and I do want to hear from certain people. And of course, none of those were going off, and I was getting lost in my work in a really good way. I was getting absorbed and I was writing, and it felt really good. So I've tried to replicate that since and just have my browser open and focus on the one thing at a time, knowing how good that can feel. But it took an accident with my computer for it to happen. I thought I was a mindful worker, but that was a really nice experience.
Even more mindful. So listeners, worklifepsych.com for your experiences. And you can also tweet at worklifepsych. Sorry, Richard, I interrupted.
No, that's the reminder we all need. Get in touch with your feedback, your thoughts and your ideas. A bit of news. On the 27th of November, I'm going to be involved in a London-wide event called Thrive in the City. And I'm mentioning it today because we're focusing on psychological flexibility, and I'm going to be running a session on psychological flexibility during that day. We'll have details up on the website, but I just wanted to share a little bit from the Thrive in the City website so you could understand how this is contributing to the day. So it's thriveinthecity.co.uk, and the event is on the 27th of November. And they say 2 million Londoners experience some form of poor mental health every year. And by working with various experts, employers, and those we seek to support, we are looking to provide a broad and diverse set of experiences to truly understand what works in the city. So they're curating a program of events celebrating mental health. Celebrating mental health. That's a key word. Mm. And it's coinciding with City Mental Health Alliance annual event and a speech from Sadiq Khan, who's the Mayor of London. So they're going to put on a whole range of different experiences that have been shown to contribute to positive mental well-being. And my session on psychological flexibility is going to be just one of those. But they have a very large number of practitioners coming in. So there's going to be an enormous amount of choice. And the entire day is free.
Wow.
So if you go to thriveinthecity.co.uk, you can see the events. They're all in the city. That's the City of London, the financial district of London. But they're all free. And there's an amazing, diverse set of events going on. So I'm delighted to be part of that, delighted to be able to support them, let them know, let the listeners know this is going on. And that's just the kind of event we'd love to be part of.
I find it amazing that it's, I love that it's free, because I think that also says something about why they're doing it also. I think it's really great. Wow.
I think it's removing one more barrier, someone could just wander in and try something out. So maybe after the event, we'll have a brief item exploring how it went and what kind of feedback we got.
Excellent. So listeners, if you are in London or around and this sounds like something you would like to attend, then send Richard a tweet at Work Life Psych. Tell him you'll be there. Tell him you listen to the podcast. He'll be very happy. Sounds really good.
Yeah, and you can also get in touch with Thrive in the City on Twitter. They're at City Thrive. City Thrive. So I know that they'd love to hear from you too.
Excellent. Well, that's, the great update. Great update.
So shall we move on
Yes.
to our first topic of the day, which is about coaching. Coaching takes up an awful lot of my professional time. It's what I do. It's what I love to do. So that's great. But it's also something that's often misunderstood. When I tell people I've just met that I do coaching, it's amazing the variety of responses I get from being very positive to being very negative, and also from sharing some stories of their own experiences that are quite sad, really, in terms of the poor coaching that they've experienced. So what I'd love to do is just clarify it a little bit, maybe challenge some of the thinking around it and bust a few myths about coaching.
So before we start, we're really, because coaching, well, like you're saying, it's a word that I've heard used for all kinds of things, meaning lots of different things. But what we're going to be talking here, I imagine, at least at the beginning, is coaching by a coach, by a professional coach. Is that
ideally?
Yeah.
Ideally.
Okay.
Well, just coaching by someone who has received some training in coaching.
Okay, so that just to separate it from the coaching practice that people might have at work. So just wanted to make that clear for listeners. Yeah.
Yes. So, a line manager could utilize coaching skills to help develop their team. That's a form of coaching. And you may get coaching from someone within your organization that you don't report to, or you may seek out a coach from outside of the organization. There's commonality across all of those interactions. My hope would be each of those people using those skills will have learned them through some quality training.
Yeah.
And will be reflective, will be trying to learn and improve their practice.
Yeah.
But asking what coaching is easy. Answering that is it's really quite difficult to do it succinctly. And so I trained a lot of people in coaching skills over the years. And so I share one consistent definition with them. I'll share with you now.
Mm.
It's from Professor Stephen Palmer, who's a bit of a luminary in the coaching space. So the ultimate aims of coaching, according to Stephen Palmer, are to facilitate personal and professional growth, learning, and optimal functioning. Thus, the initial motivation is a focus on optimization and improvement of performance as opposed to the elimination of any problems. So that is a really positive definition. It's about improvement and growth, not doing to someone else, not fixing people. It's letting them become the best they want to be. And I think that's an important distinction to make, because it's one of the, I'd say, misunderstandings that people have about coaching, that they can send one of their team members to me and I'll somehow fix them or change them. You know, we want to focus on what's within the person and allow them to grow into that, to develop to where they want to be. So I would say it's also, you know, when I say to someone, this is part of what I do, they imagine it's some kind of therapy or some kind of counseling. And of course, coaching is really quite different to both of those on a number of levels. One, I'm not qualified to counsel, provide therapy, but also the focus, what we're working on together, is quite different. The theme, the issue at hand, you know, while counseling and therapy could really focus on quite significant mental health challenges, for example, I might work with someone to help them identify the next steps in their career. You know, so it's really about the workplace focus.
Okay, can you tell us a bit more about, just briefly, about the relationship or difference between the three, coaching, counseling, and therapy, and when do you know that you are moving on from coaching into counseling, which you probably wouldn't want to do as a coach? Do you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. And you wouldn't want to move from coaching to counseling unless you're a practitioner who has qualifications in both.
Yeah.
And you are doing that with intent. You know you're doing it, and that the client knows, the coachee knows that that's happening too. But it's one of the most important things I include in coaching training, which is for the coaches to recognize the limits of their competence and to know what kind of topics generally are suitable for coaching and which are not. So while coaching and counseling and psychotherapy share some core themes, they are in a sense helping relationships, and they all involve a professional listening to someone and in a sense trying to help them get to where they want to get to. The content of those conversations will be really different. Really importantly, the length of the relationship will be different. By and large, coaching is quite a time-limited relationship. And by time-limited, I mean I might work with someone for 4 to 6 coaching sessions. Counseling could go on much longer than that. And psychotherapy could go on forever, depending on your school of thought, depending on what kind of therapist you are. So we have the duration of the relationship. Some would argue the power distance between the two individuals involved is different too. A psychotherapist might adopt the more senior position in the relationship, a little bit like when you go to see your GP. You don't expect your GP to say, well, I don't know, let's collaborate and find out. You know, you want them to say, oh, I've listened to you and I think it's this. Whereas the coach is not an expert in the topic being discussed. And that's really useful to understand, because someone might say, well, I'm not sure you could coach in my organization because you've never done this job before. Well, actually, if I was coaching you, you're the expert in your career and your life experience. I bring different skill sets to the table, and that's around helping you maybe see things you're not aware of, asking you challenging questions, and helping you shape a plan to get to where you want to be. So otherwise, I think at this stage in my career, I'd only be coaching other psychologists. You know, so I don't have to be the expert in the domain in which you work. Familiarity with it would be great, but I don't have to be the expert.
Yeah, carry on.
Well, it's really to illustrate the difference between these things. And of course, the qualifications are different. Now, qualifications in coaching, well, we'll come to that at the end, shall we? We'll cover a few more things. Yes. But it's a bit of a bone of contention. But it's also different to the relationship you have with your line manager, in that the coach doesn't have authority over you. Now, you might have the nicest, friendliest line manager in the world, but they still have authority over you. And they can explicitly or implicitly you know, reserve a threat. If you don't do this, there's going to be consequences. Whereas the coach might say, well, if you don't follow through on your plan, I'm not going to lose any sleep. You've made a commitment to do it, but I'm not going to be chasing you down for this. It's much more of a relationship of equals. And so you can be, hopefully, much more open with your coach than you might with your line manager, because your line manager always has that seniority. Whether or not they use that, it sits with them. And of course, it's very different to the relationship you might have with a friend. A friend may console you when you're having a hard time of things and tell you, you know, it's not your fault. Your boss sounds like a monster. You know, have another pint. But the coach's job is to be supportive, but also challenging, and ask questions like, well, have you given any feedback to your manager? And you seem to be blaming your manager for everything. Might part of the problem be arising from how you are talking to your manager, or, you know, things like that. So it's one where we emphasize being supportive and demonstrating empathy, but also holding the coachee to account for what they say they're going to do and opening up the conversation in a different way. So that can be a bit challenging. There's a tension there. If you have a lot of empathy in the relationship, some coachees might think you're more like their friend, and you need to bring that back to a different level. Anyway, it's just about being aware of where the conversation and where the relationship is going. So it's quite a unique relationship in that sense. And it's an exciting place to work, and it's a creative place to work. But because it is so different, it's important that you get that across at the beginning of a coaching program, so that the client, the coachee, understands the boundaries of that relationship.
So can you give us an example of something that you might have been working with someone on, or an example of a few coaching sessions? If we haven't worked with a coach before, so that we can get some idea what it might feel like, look like.
So yes, within the bounds of confidentiality, which is a major part of this. Coaching, there is no one method. And this is a real challenge, because every so often academics will survey coaches and ask them about their practice. And there are so many theoretical frameworks that coaches use, so many theoretical backgrounds that they will bring. So this, I would argue, you know, the church of coaching is a very broad church. Yeah. But I'll talk about what approach I would take in terms of, maybe I'm working with you, Pilar, for 6 sessions, and we'll spend the beginning getting to know each other, for me to understand why it is that you think coaching could be helpful, for me to explain to you, as I just have, what coaching is about, what it's not about. And then we'd agree, if it was going to work that way, we'd agree what goal it was you wanted to work towards, or what challenge you wanted to work through. And then we'd agree towards the end of that session the things that you were going to do between today and the next time we sit down. And that's a rhythm that's established to coaching conversations. The coachee goes away to do something. Now, it might be to have a think about their situation. It could be to experiment with new ways of interacting with other people. It could be to go and do some homework, in inverted commas. Maybe they're going to keep a journal about their thinking. Something. They're going off to do something. Without action, coaching is just a nice chat. So I really emphasize that. And we would work on that rhythm. You would come back and let me know how those things had worked for you, what your experience had been. We'd move you forward a little bit further. And maybe if it's 6 sessions, during session 3, we'd have a midpoint review. Where have we got to on the various things you wanted to work towards? And then on session 5, what I tend to do is ask someone to start preparing their summary of how coaching has gone for them. So by the time we wrap up on coaching session 6, they've got some kind of document for themselves that lists how far they've moved from where they've gone, how they've got there, what kind of tools and techniques they've used. And it's preparing them for your absence, for when the coach is gone. That's a really important point. It's an important aspect of how I like to do coaching. I'm preparing the coachee from the very beginning. I'm not going to be around forever. So I want to make sure that you're equipped with what you need to successfully complete this, but also maybe generalize to other situations that are different but similar. because I don't think anyone out there has the resources to keep going back to a coach every time this is a slightly different thing manifests. So there's an element of I'm doing less and less as we go along, and you're doing more and more.
Yeah,
and that's the rhythm that I would try and stick to.
Yeah, you don't want any dependency in the end, because also then you do become like a, yeah, the relationship changes if you're always going to be there when someone needs help. Yeah. It's a capacity building thing, I imagine, sometimes.
Exactly. And dependency is something to keep an eye out for, because it's not sustainable and it's outside the ethos of coaching, really.
So so a couple of examples. So that's how like the rhythm, and I can start to see the relationship between the coach and coachee. So within the context of an organization, because you said, for example, at the beginning, you might decide what they want to get from the coaching sessions. Do you find that's quite common just for someone to say, okay, you can work with a coach, or I want to work with a coach? Or is it also a case of, we think this person could work with a coach to do X, or I would like to use a coach or work with a coach to do whatever or to improve whatever?
All of the above. it's sometimes that someone will put their hand up and say, you know, a common starting point is they've had some feedback within the workplace, and they think, you know, I'm hearing this again and again. I want to work on this. Or they've been told, you know what, if you want to get to the next level here, you really need to work on these skills or, you know, whatever it might be. But they've had some kind of feedback from their environment, and they either put their own hand up and say, I'd like a coach, or it's suggested to them that they may find coaching useful. When I interact with most organizations, we'll have what we call a chemistry meeting, which could be a Skype session or a face-to-face, where it's just, let's get to know each other. Let me understand what it is that you want to work on, so I can understand if you want to be here, and what it is that you would like to work on, so I can understand, is that something that is appropriate for coaching? And I want to know if they want to be there, because it does happen that someone is told you need to get some coaching and they don't want to be there. And of course, that's not going to work. It's not going to benefit anybody. And so I'll step away from those. And of course, sometimes, not often, but I have had the experience a few times where someone wants a coach, but they don't know why. You dig a little bit and then you realize, all their peers have a coach. And so they think they should have a coach too. And that's not a good use of resources at all. I do have people who approach me directly, find me online, whatever it might be. And I have organizations that I work with regularly, and I'll work with managers of a similar level or certain executives, or we'll take a cohort. Maybe new graduates will go through some coaching. So the avenues towards coaching are many and varied, but I guess the most important thing is that the person wants to be there and that they remain wanting to be there because they're getting something out of it. So dialogue through coaching is really important. You know, you're not doing coaching to someone, you're working with them throughout. And so keeping that conversation going is really important.
And well, you probably, the answer is going to be again abroad of things. What are some of the things that people either come to you specifically for coaching about, or that they're sent to? So is it, I suppose it's not skills, is it mainly behavior, or what kind of things?
Many different things. So some topics that I've helped people with over the last few years would be maybe to increase the amount of delegation that they do.
Right.
You know, and it's not because they don't know how to delegate. I don't think I've met anyone who doesn't know how to delegate. It might be about improving how they do that. But a lot of the time, there's something about their thinking and their assumptions and their personality that makes it more difficult for them. So they may be saying to themselves, you know, the classical trap of, well, it's quicker if I do it myself. Mm-hmm. It may be because they don't trust their team. It may be because they feel that they can't let go of certain tasks because they're important to them or enjoyable to them. But it's about discussing those and experimenting with new ways of behaving. So I would say most of my coaching addresses both our thinking and our behaviors. And I think it's important to focus on the both. I spend a lot of time working with people on their productivity, helping them focus on priorities, addressing work-life balance challenges. Stress comes up quite a bit, and they often don't fit neatly into boxes. What you'll find is someone on day one wants to talk about X, and as trust grows, they might bring in a few other things that they feel comfortable mentioning. So keeping on track and making sure we both know what we're talking about and why we're talking about it is really key. But it can be that they open up and tell you more as you go along and you realize this is a slightly different challenge, or this helps me better understand why they're here in front of me and not the socially acceptable thing that they told their line manager at the very beginning.
So I suppose that this is where the confusion with or the mistaking this for counseling and therapy is that actually there is a lot. I mean, you do have to go into yourself if you're a coachee. But the difference is that, for example, you said, why can't I delegate well? Instead of going, oh, where does that come from? And where does those blocks come from? Actually, it's not that's happening. Let's see what we can do to move you forwards.
Yes, yes. And it's very different to say their manager saying, here's how I delegate. Yeah. You do it the same. Mm-hmm. That's like mentoring. Or me giving them a checklist saying, here's your 5 top tips for delegating. You can have as many instructions as you like. If you don't feel motivated to do it, or you feel afraid of doing it, or you find all kinds of other ways to get around that behavior, then it's worth talking about the why and the motivation and the thinking that sit behind that.
So I suppose if I'm thinking whether if I maybe I have come across a stumbling block, or like you say, I'm getting this feedback and I'm thinking of approaching a coach, I suppose I need to be aware that going through that coaching relationship is going to take a lot from me also.
It may. It may be a very transactional but helpful. I don't mean transactional in a negative way. It could be a very straightforward transactional. Let's get you your new job. And it's quite structured and goal-oriented. And you go off in between the coaching sessions and you carry out your homework. And you clarify where you want to get to. You improve your CV, whatever those activities are. And you work on your interviewing technique. And you may do some role play with the coach about answering difficult questions. Another scenario would be, you know what, this person's been recommended they get some coaching because they keep losing their temper. And they're not even aware they're doing it, but they've had the feedback and they disagree with that. That's a whole different kind of conversation that's going to go on. And it may be that, you know, consistent feedback does open their eyes, or that I give them some feedback. You know, I've had people tell me that they don't lose their temper while losing their temper at me in the room when it's just the two of us. And I'm not the only coach that's happened to. I'm not the only psychologist that's happened to. So this is what I mean about it being very broad. We're using really similar techniques and we're using a similar ethos, but the topics that could sit within it are many and varied. The ones that sit outside of it are really quite clear. We generally don't work with mental health issues because they're outside of my competence or our competence, and not management issues, you know, line management or performance management issues where someone has broken rules. You know, there's normally a process. So, for example, if someone is bullying, well, then the organization has a process that they follow to bring that to its conclusion. That's not generally a situation where the bully gets to see a coach before anything else happens. And then, of course, there's other well-being issues like substance abuse. Generally don't work with people on things that are 100% in their home life. So it's generally about the workplace, their well-being, their success, their performance.
Nice. So if someone wants to, I suppose I'm starting to think through the last bit of our planning for the topic. If someone does decide that they want to work with a coach, and how do they go about it, or in what ways have you seen people go about it?
So it may be that they work in a large organization which has some internal coaches, and they can be accessed via the HR function or the L&D team. It may be that they work in a smaller organization, but they know someone in their network, in their professional network, who's found coaching beneficial. Because on that note, I really try and remove the stigma attached from coaching. It shouldn't be a secret, and I encourage my coachees to talk about their coaching with other people so that they can explain the changes that other people see in them. So they may find that in their network, there are people who would recommend a coach. That doesn't mean they're going to be the perfect coach for them, but that's where they could start that journey. I tend not to recommend people just go online. And one of the reasons for that is it's not a protected title. So anyone can call themselves a coach. And so if you go online, you may just stumble across some really slick websites with someone who's invested a lot in creating a great image, but they may not have the skills, the training, and the ethos that sit well with coaching, but they can call themselves a coach. And that's, I would imagine, why so many of the people I talk to about coaching have had a not so great experience. So there is a register of coaching psychologists that the British Psychological Society maintains. And everyone on that register, which is publicly searchable, has qualifications, appropriate qualifications in both psychology and coaching. And so we'll put a link to that register in the show notes. And that's a really good starting point if there aren't any internal resources where you work or where you would prefer your coaching to be separate to where you work. And that's another reason why sometimes I'll see people in the evening. They'd like to leave the office, put some space between them and the office, and come to my office, and it be a completely separate experience for them.
Because I suppose the role of the coach as an external party is very important.
That's a really interesting one, because yes, you can bring a fresh pair of eyes. You are objective as the coach. That's the expectation. And you have the latitude to ask some really naive questions, yeah, because you're not on the inside, and maybe you don't know a lot about what that person does, what their role is. But big, broad, naive questions can really open the conversation and challenge the coachee to talk about things in more detail, especially if they're skipping all over the place in terms of their story, or if they're making some assumptions about how things are.
Yeah. Excellent. Oops, sorry, I don't know if I interrupted there, Richard.
I was just going to say that you know, recently there's more and more evidence demonstrating that internal coaches can be as effective. Yeah. Now, research on coaching is challenging for the very reason I mentioned earlier. There are so many approaches to coaching that it's, you know, barely one coherent thing. So when someone asks, does coaching work? I always answer, well, that's like asking, does medicine work?
Yeah.
You know, you really need to be more specific than that. But it can be very attractive as an activity for people to get involved in. I'd always say, please do your research. If you're looking for a coach, be demanding in your research. And if you want to become a coach, you're going to have to do a lot of training if you want to be a good ethical practitioner. It is demanding, but rewarding. And it's not something you should just assume you could do after a few days of training.
Oh, yes. Do you have to go through coaching yourself, I imagine, as a coach in your training?
So as part of the training, good training, you will do a lot of practical coaching with other people on the course, both using your skills and observing what it's like to see coaching and what it's like to be coached. Yeah. So you can hone your skills and be reflective. Outside of that, maybe when your training has ended, and I don't even know when that is, because I continue to go back and learn things and do things, because continuing professional development is important. But it's important to have some level of supervision so that another professional you can talk to about your coaching practice. And I and my colleagues, we do peer supervision. We all get on a call and we walk through maybe something we've learned, a paper we've come across, a challenge someone has faced, and we talk it through and try and identify any learnings. Or we say, you know what, you handled that really well. Mm-hmm. Don't be worried about that. But that's a really useful avenue for a coach to have. Without that, you know, you could take a lot on your shoulders, or you could simply be making the same mistake over and over again.
Yeah. Great. So Richard, before we move on to our next segment, is there anything else you want to say to wrap up this wonderful segment on coaching?
Well, we could talk about it for hours, and yep, we probably will, but we've got a blog post, Five Myths About Coaching, that I put together, I think last year. It's on the blog. We'll put a link to that in the show notes. And it really illustrates, these are the things that people sometimes misunderstand about coaching. And once you're on that blog post, you can see the other blog posts that talk about coaching, if that's of interest to you. But anyone who's listening, who's interested in getting a coach or wants to know what questions they should be asking a coach, feel free to get in touch with us, because we can recommend people if you don't want to work with us, and we can clarify things that you could ask somebody else. So we'd really like to improve the practice of coaching more generally.
Listeners, worklifepsych.com, the contact form there for long form communication. Or if you have something that you can say to us in 140 characters, then at worklifepsych. So yes, do send any questions through about coaching. So, Richard.
So, we're back to psychological flexibility.
Yes. Where are we at?
Well, this is the second of the three slots, if you like, on the podcast where we're going to talk about psychological flexibility. And as we said in the introduction, this time we're going to look a little bit at how helpful it is to try and let go of troubling thoughts and emotions. Let's take a step back, though. By way of reminder, psychological flexibility is a collection of skills and processes we can develop that help us better deal with challenges in life by allowing us to be more mindful and focused and to have a better relationship with our thoughts and emotions. Now, we introduced it in episode 3, so if you haven't heard that, it might be good to go back and listen to that, maybe if this is a new concept to you, because if not, we're sort of starting halfway through. But last time we talked about how helpful it can be to get a focus on the present, to be more mindful about what we're doing and to notice more about what we're doing, to show up. That's the first bit. Today we're going to look at letting go. And that's made up of two different but related processes. So we're on to the thinking about your thinking. Now, you touched on this when we spoke last time about the relationship you have with your thoughts and thinking about your own thoughts and emotions. And that's really what this is. So many of us can operate on a kind of an automatic pilot a lot of the time. We're not really aware of the thoughts that are going through our heads and sometimes not even of the emotions we're feeling. We're responding to them in an automatic way, as if that was our programming. So I thought this, I felt this, I did this in rapid succession. And that can often feel like I thought this, so I must do this, or I feel this, so now I should become this. And you can see it. If someone allows their emotions to really overspill, they become the emotion behaviorally. You can see it in everything from their body language, their facial expression, how they're speaking. Everything's impacted by the emotion. But if it's an unhelpful emotion, what that means is it can impact us on multiple levels in a way that's not helpful in terms of the clarity of our thinking and our decision making. And we may end up doing or saying something that we later regret. And that's because we've allowed those thoughts and those emotions to direct how we do things. And the letting go element of psychological flexibility is all about changing that relationship so that we decide what we'd like to do and we don't let passing thoughts and passing emotions tell us.
And you can see how this goes so closely with that mindfulness to really, I suppose, this is what I'm getting from it, that it's about, okay, I am feeling this now, right, what's my next step?
Yeah, if you have that contact with the present moment, then it's going to help you be aware of what's going on inside. If you are caught up with the future or the past, or you're busy multitasking and distracting yourself, it's going to be a little bit harder to listen to that narrative that's going on inside, or to be really aware of maybe the physical symptoms in your body that are a good clue as to what emotion you're feeling. Because we can often feel our emotions physically. So contact with the present moment facilitates that. And all of these different skills we talk about, they all facilitate each other. So you mentioned last time, where should we start? I started with contact with the present moment because it's an easy place to start the conversation. But if you started with letting go and dealing with your thoughts differently and then taught someone about mindfulness, that could have the same impact. They all touch and facilitate each other, which is quite nice.
I forgot about that it wasn't a linear a linear journey through the three aspects. Yes.
No, it can just be a nice place to start. And actually, it can be a nice place to start with a group of people just to get them to take a few mindful breaths and relax into something, rather than typical training, which can be, now pay attention, brace yourself, I'm going to fill your head with knowledge. Yes. You know, to set the tone to be a little bit different. So I mentioned last time that psychological flexibility is supported by a large number of practitioners around the world, and they're very generous with what they have created and what they give away to help people to understand the concept and the processes. And they all use metaphors and imagery a lot, because we're talking about something that's quite intangible a lot of the time. We're talking about thoughts and memories and emotions. So I thought I would use a couple of those to bring the letting go element of this to light. The first one is this notion of the passengers on the bus. And this may be one you've seen or heard before, but if you were to picture yourself as a bus driver and your job is to bring the bus on a tour to show people the sights, it's a nice rewarding job, and the passengers get on and they want to be taken around the place. Some of those passengers are lovely. But as we all know, not every passenger is going to be a nice, cooperative, pleasant passenger. Some of them sit at the back of the bus and they're telling you you're going too fast. Others are shouting you're going too slow. Some of them are telling you that you should give up your job completely because you're not good enough. You're the worst bus driver they've ever seen. Others are telling you to take a different route because it's dangerous the way you're going. And others are saying, pull in now. Just stop. We all want to get off the bus. Now, it's a metaphor. Yeah. So the passengers on the bus, what do you think they are, Pilar?
Well, they're all our thoughts.
Yeah. Now, if you're a professional bus driver, what would you do with those people shouting at you from the back of the bus?
Well, if you're a professional bus driver and you know your stuff, you ignore them or you stop and tell them to shut up and then you carry on. Or kick them off the bus. Kick them off the bus.
I love it. Well, you know, the company you work for doesn't allow you to wrestle these people to the ground and throw them off, you know. And it's the same with our thoughts. We can't get rid of thoughts. We can't suppress them for very long. And we can't stop thinking about something once we've had that thought. We can't erase them. And it's the same with emotions. We can't really push them back down. But you're quite right. What we can do is focus on the task at hand, which is driving the bus as well as we can towards our ultimate destination. And we can do it while trying to ignore the people that are telling us different and possibly unpleasant things. And those voices, those passengers, are the thoughts. And the thing about the thoughts and the emotions is that they pass. So if you pay too much attention to one, it'll hang around longer than it needs to, because they are ephemeral and they move on like a stream. And if you try and do something with them, you're beginning a struggle. And you know what? The thought of the emotion is going to win. Struggling with them, it takes up energy. And it means, if you can imagine, you were picking them up off the ground, you've soon got an armful of thoughts and emotions. And now, what do I do with these? I'm not quite sure. I can't get rid of them. And while I'm dealing with these, I can't do the thing I really want to do. So trying to ignore them, we can do that by just putting a bit of distance between us and them, treating our thoughts like things, like objects, like something you could pick up in your hand, rather than an instruction for action. I've had this thought, so therefore I need to do something with it.
I suppose the thing that came to mind, but this makes sense, the really, especially if you can separate them, I don't know, maybe I'm over intellectualizing, but the thing I was thinking about is, what if one of those thoughts is really useful?
Mm-hmm.
What if one of those people is saying, look, you've got something right in front of you?
So it's about having the awareness that there is an element of your thinking that's helpful, and there's an element of your thinking that's not helpful. Mm-hmm. It's not deciding that every single thought you encounter needs action. Right. Needs addressing or needs to be put away somehow. Examining your thoughts and being mindful about that experience will allow you to take action. The thing that's going to direct what we do is not passing thoughts, but the values that we want to live to, the values that we've identified as being important for us. That's the guide that we want to talk about. And that's what we're going to talk about next time. The value of values, the value of being clear on what's important to you and then doing that. Because if we allow passing thoughts to direct our attention, our focus, and our behavior, we've no way of knowing if we're A, going in the right direction, because it's a little bit like when we talked about email. If you spend all your time answering the next email that comes in, the important stuff can be left undone, unfinished. So we need to know what our priorities are And in this case, we need to know what our values are so that we can continue to go in that direction. And sometimes the thoughts will be completely aligned with our values and they'll help us understand something. But sometimes there'll be thoughts that say, you're no good at this. Don't try. You're going to fail. They're not helpful thoughts. But we can't say, I shouldn't have those thoughts, because we'll make a connection with the thoughts. Yeah. So what we want to do is just put some distance, allow them to be, allow them to float by, and really get connected with our values and follow through on that action.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So if you imagined yourself, and this is where, you know, visualizing things can be really helpful. If you imagined yourself lying in a lovely meadow in the grass and you're looking up at the sky, all of those clouds that go by are thoughts. And it's not helpful to you to try and track the cloud and count the clouds and categorize the clouds. You can just enjoy them going by, because there's another one and then there's another one, and you can just let that go by. You can also visualize yourself standing in a stream and you can watch everything that's floating on the water go past you. It's part of the stream. You're in the stream, but you're not bending over trying to pick up every leaf and twig and categorize them and do something with them. You can just watch them go by. And it's like that with our thoughts. Mm. They're not an instruction manual. They don't need to be addressed. You don't need to do something with each one. Because like I said, you'll then begin a struggle with things you don't like the sound of. It's easier, although a little bit counterintuitive, to just let go, let that thought go.
Yeah, I can really see the connection with the being in the moment that we looked at last week. And this,
good.
And I can't wait to hear the next, the next bit, the bit that looks at values and then making your decisions and actions around those. Wow,
it's really useful that you can see those connections, and we're trying to keep it as simple as possible. Mm. So the notion of getting some distance between us and our thoughts can feel quite conceptual. And one of the ways to do that is based on language, because language is so clearly linked with our thinking and dot, dot, dot. So instead of saying, you know, I shouldn't do this, you could say to yourself, I'm having the thought that I shouldn't do this. Or instead of saying, I'm furious, you could say, I notice I'm feeling the emotion called fury. Now, it might sound a bit strange when you say it like that. It might sound a bit stilted. But what you're doing is talking about that's an experience or that's a concept. You're not becoming the thing. You're not becoming fused with the thought and the emotion, and unable to tell what came first and unable to separate your behavior and your actions from them. And that's one of the things that we talk about, one of the processes, cognitive defusion. Taking apart thoughts, emotions, and behavior and acknowledging they can be separate. Mm. And of course, accepting that you will continue to have them. Acceptance is a big part of this. Practicing these techniques don't mean you will reach some kind of Zen-like calm. You will continue to have thoughts that are troubling, and you will continue to experience emotions that are unpleasant. Acceptance means that you acknowledge that and you keep going anyway. Without acceptance, we're tempted to avoid them. And so if you think about the difference between focusing on your values directing you versus the everything to do with avoiding unpleasant emotions, those two drives could take you in very different ways. Working towards a values-aligned goal could mean experiencing some unpleasant emotions along the way. But if all you're concerned about is avoiding unpleasant or uncomfortable emotions, then you might miss out on great developing experiences or things that are really meaningful to you in your life. Mm-hmm. So every time I talk to a group about this, the example I give is the school disco. You're in the school disco. Can you remember the school disco?
I didn't go. No, yes, I could.
You're in the school and you want to ask someone to dance, but the passengers on your bus start saying, what if they say no? You'll be humiliated. Other people will see it. You'll never be able to ask anyone else. You'll look like such a fool, and they'll talk about you for weeks. So then you say, well, I'm not going to ask them to dance because that's safe. and I'll go back and I'll stand against the wall for the rest of the evening. And that is safe. There's no humiliation or embarrassment, but there's also no positive experience of dancing with someone. So each of these actions that we take does come at the risk of an unpleasant emotion, but they pass. So if you spend your time trying to avoid unpleasant experiences, emotions or thoughts, then you miss out on those opportunities for growth. And that experiential avoidance means that your life, you know, the boundaries of your life get smaller and smaller and smaller and less fulfilling and less growth oriented. Whereas if you say, I'm really scared, they're going to say no, but I do really want to dance. And what's the worst that could happen? And you ask them. And they might say no, but you asked. And maybe you learned something from how you asked or who you asked, but you've learned something and you've experienced something. So listening to the drive within you, listening to, am I running towards something or running away from something, can be really, really enlightening experience.
Mm-hmm. I also think it's really stressful to try and avoid emotions and negative thoughts and stuff like that, because they're just part of, I think they're just part of us, and our brain just goes everywhere and we want to avoid danger and we want to see danger. I think it's very stressful to try and avoid it. So I really like that, okay, they're there, let them go through, and then, you know, we'll see what we can do to guide our behavior if we don't want those negative thoughts to guide our behavior.
Mm. Yeah, I'm grinning from ear to ear. You've expressed that much more clearly than I have.
Excellent. So I was thinking about there was, yeah. Yeah, what else, Richard? So,
well, I mean, that's it in a nutshell, in a sense. Yeah. I mean, the key takeaways that I would like everyone to think about are, you know, a thought is just a thought. It's going to pass, and there'll be another one along any minute. So don't take every thought as being something that's true or literal or an instruction. And practicing thinking about your thinking and talking to yourself about your thoughts, like I'm having the thought, or I'm saying to myself, or even Richard is having the thought, or Pilar is having the thought, you're putting even more distance there. It can illustrate you what kind of themes there are in your thinking, and also illustrate some of the daft thoughts that we have that, you know, it's best not to take action on. And the same with emotions, noticing them, describing them, letting them pass. The bottom line is, with this inner life that we have, we can't throw the passengers off the bus. We can't wrestle them. They're stronger than us, but we can stop giving them much attention and we can carry on doing the things that are important to us. And those important things are what we'll talk about next time.
Wonderful. Well, listeners, there you have it. If you want to get in touch with us before the next episode, or maybe at some point, because the recording schedule is, of course, slightly different to the release schedule, but do get in touch with any thoughts on this second stage of psychological flexibility, on the coaching theme that we were talking about. And if there's anything that you've always wanted to know about psychology, or a topic that is related to what we talk about here that you'd like to know about, let us know. I'm sure Richard will be able to handle it.
Someone at this end will be able to handle it. And of course, our guides to psychological flexibility is available for download from worklifepsych.com/psychological-flexibility, all one word. And that's free. And that will give you a lot more detail than we cover in the podcast, as well as some reflective exercises to help you bring all of this to life.
Great. And if you do download that, let us know, even just with a tweet at Work Life Psych. It will be great. Let us know how you found it, if you put anything into practice, etc., etc. Well, listeners, well, Richard, I think that's it for episode number 4 of my Pocket Psych, isn't it?
We're there. Next time, we're going to talk about work-life balance. Dun, dun. Big topic.
And the third, is it going to be the third and last section of psychological flexibility, or do we have more to come?
Well, the third and last for introducing it. I know it's going to come up again as we talk about different subjects. It's very applicable to them, but we will be talking about that. Get moving, take some action in line with your values, and really applicable to making changes in your experience of work-life balance.
Excellent. Well, Richard, it's been lovely to listen to you, to speak to you, to ask you questions.
Great to speak with you as well, Pilar.
And listeners, thank you very, very much for listening.